Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this weekly, the air is full of bleeps, bongs and cryptic messages, not to mention some lost moments of Italian-Irish Baroque. Later on, violinist Dara Morgan on retooling the Valencia Chamber Music Festival for the times we live in. And we download Neutrino Watch, the AI-flavoured podcast that's never the same twice. But we begin with drummer, composer and professor of composition Dominic Murcott and everything he's learned from his long study of the methods, maths and music of composer Conlon Nancarrow. Murcott is a self-taught musician whose journey through music began with jazz and punk, some brushes with stardom with acts such as the High Llamas and Pavement, as well as more recent voyages into classical music. Nancarrow was an American-born 20th century composer who used the unhuman possibilities of machines to discover new musical forms. In his musical journeys, Murcott follows in Nancarrow's footsteps, but instead of the player pianos that inspired Nancarrow, Murcott goes mining for patterns in everything from bells, as in the harmonic canon, a sculpture-come-musical instrument, all the way to the hackable circuits of modular synthesizers. Louise McMahon shared some sawtooth waves with Dominic Murcott.
I was a self-taught musician as a kid. I didn't have formal lessons. I started as a drummer, as a teenager, went on to play with a lot of experimental music, some kind of more popular stuff, and gradually drifted from being a self-taught drummer into composing. I did, as a mature student, go to university, and I've done the academic things and have a PhD. I'm head of composition at Trinity Laban Conservatoire of Music and Dance in Greenwich in London. Mainly what I do is compose. I do some playing still. And I do a mixture of acoustic and electronic things. I do things with film and lots of different technology. The piece that's been very successful for me in the last few years is this piece called The Harmonic Canon. The Harmonic Canon is the name of the piece, but it's also the name of this huge bell, which is made by a bell maker called Marcus Vergette. Large bells are hidden. We hear them from, you know, somewhere inside church towers. They're not things that we can see. They're not things that we can approach. So he had this idea to make essentially two bells on a stand that could be rolled onto a stage and can be a piece of public sculpture. This thing lives at the moment in the courtyard at the old Royal Naval College in Greenwich, which is where Trinity Laban is. The bell can spin inside its cradle. You know, it weighs half a ton. I wrote a piece for two percussionists who play the bell, plus all sorts of other metal percussion. The guy who recorded it for us and co-produced it with me is a guy called Julian Heppel, who was Prince's sound engineer. The piece has two movements. One is very complex and fast and takes even very, very good players a long time to learn. And the other is slow, and it's essentially one kind of gradually changing tone. I mean, the joy of this particular composition is that working with Marcus, the bell maker, there were certain ideas built into the bells. So there's two of them, and they're tuned a semitone apart. We don't get to hear large bells a semitone apart. We tend to hear them in pentatonic scales or whatever. Within those two semitone parts, the lower one has a prominent major third and the upper one has a prominent minor third, which is actually the same note. But it's not perfectly in tune, so if you hit both together, that common tone doesn't quite fit, so you get these wonderful complex beating patterns. The bell has ridges on it, which means if you strike those ridges, it excites certain frequencies. When you hear it, it actually sounds like there's multiple instruments playing, but it's literally just playing these two bells with drumsticks. So the starting point was taking things that actually came from the bell itself. Let's make the point where they're playing the bell the key point. If that's fast, let's begin one aspect of the music slowly and gradually speed towards that. Let's take another part fast and gradually slow towards that. Oh, and there's another compositional idea which was fun, is that I really wanted this to be released on vinyl. You can fit approximately 21 minutes of good audio quality on vinyl, so I wrote it to be two 21-minute movements specifically for that. These were the structural starting points.
Conlon Nancrow, can you talk to me more about your excursion into his music?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've just been a fan of his for a long time. In 2010, I just got stuck into researching him. You know, he had the first ever home recording studio, working with player pianos where he punched holes into rolls. He could essentially make computer music, but with these beautiful, very analog devices. I feel great empathy with his digital versus analog relationship. His music is so much about structure. He often conceives of a structure that has limitations and problems in it, and then works on producing the notes that fulfill the ambitions of these structures. I've taken a lot of that. So the way I wrote the harmonic canon was, I mean, I literally structured the whole piece out before I began to write too much of the material. And I found that very liberating. He wrote approximately 50 studies for player piano. They were all called study number one, study number two, and sometimes you get 3A and 3B, so there's not a lot in the title. One of his most famous ones is study number 21, which is simply a very fast line getting slower and a very slow line getting faster. And there is nothing like it. Still, it was written, you know, approximately, you know, around 1950. Nancrow's interest was in musical time. What happens if we separate out musical time? So instead of, you know, two players playing at the same speed, what happens if they're playing at speeds that are different but have a mathematical relationship? So if it's 2-1, one player is playing twice as fast as the other. But he was interested in more difficult ratios. So what happens if you have 3-5? Or what happens if you have the same material transposed to different registers on the piano at the registers of 17-18-19-20? So these are beyond the capabilities of humans. We can't play 16-17 accurately for 4 minutes. If you work with these structures and you layer them in certain ways, the musical seems to be rushing towards a certain place. And then it all seems to be relaxing away from that certain place. So some of it is quite explicit, but a lot of it is buried in there. But he used maths to lead ideas that aren't natural human ideas. They're not things that you'd sit at a piano and just imagine. Modular synthesis has kind of arrived from all sorts of ideas. Anything that calls itself a synthesizer, whether it's a computer software or, you know, a beautiful keyboard from the early 1980s. Inside, the way synthesizers tend to be designed is that they're built up of kind of internal units that affect and interact with each other. When synthesizers started to be made commercially in the late 60s, a number of companies realized that if you made them not as complete units but as separate modules, then people could buy the modules they wanted and they could build up unique synthesizers, you know, things that were unique to them. As kind of digital technology came in the 80s, this sort of fell out of fashion. But a couple of companies continued making this, particularly a German company called Dopfer. And then at some point in the 90s and in the 2000s, people started taking an interest in them again. And now there are hundreds of companies making modules. So the idea is that you buy a case and then you buy separate modules. So the way I would work with it is either commit to just using this setup and try and make a piece of music, but I tend to kind of combine this with other things and other instruments and other recording techniques. The one I've got in front of me is one I've built myself. What's interesting now, and I think why they're such a kind of popular thing, is that, first of all, again, you customize it. You buy the modules that you like, and they all do different things. So everyone's setup is slightly different. But secondly is that they're full of limitations, and so they're all connected together by cables. Unlike if you work on a computer, you can save your steps. Let's carry on tomorrow and we'll carry on where we are. The thing about modular synths is a lot of these units don't have presets. So you plug in cables and you fiddle with the knobs and you make sounds that you like. If you like something, you might never be able to get that exactly the same again. So you can work for hours on it and struggle and then suddenly hit upon something that you like, and then you have to capture it because it would be gone. With temperature changes, some of these modules go out of tune and things like that. It's a bit more like playing an instrument than simply either writing code or pressing buttons on a computer.
Would you like to do the demo of it?
I'll do my best. So yeah. I'll sort of work with a kind of fairly simple idea. So there is a tone, and this is a triangle wave. And so that's an oscillator producing a triangle wave, and I can change the octave. And then it gets more interesting if I use a separate module then to manipulate the frequency. For those of you who in the know will recognise a classic bit of frequency modulation there. So you can make random, erratic things. And then here's something slightly more ordered. And of course it sounds very similar to old school games. And it is in fact very close to the way that those 1970s games would have produced sounds. And then I've got various other ways of modulating the sound there. So, and now just changing the tone, I have a little sequencer here that's changing the pitches very gradually. And I can start manipulating the shape of these sounds. Filtering out some frequencies. Changing timbres, changing tempos. I've got a little spring reverb unit built into it. Inside the box there is literally a case with two springs in it, and the sound goes in at one spring and is picked up the other spring, and that produces this lovely rough sounding reverb. Now I'll bring in a second oscillator. And then there's also kind of modules that do bits of percussion. So I have a nice little sequence going there, and I can start playing with the sequence. One of the things that would be anathema to so much music is that I programmed in a vaguely 3-4-6-8 pattern and a sequence that fitted that. Then I made it longer so the sequence didn't fit the percussion pattern. The vagaries of this setup here is there's no guarantee that beat one of the sequence will fit to beat one of the percussion. And there are ways that I can start and stop that, but I quite enjoyed the jeopardy of not knowing quite how the sequence was going to interlock. If we imagined writing a piece of music for a group of players and not being sure if we all agree on beat one. You know, there's all sorts of music that's going to fail with that. In this particular case, I think it adds to the fun of it. I hope that gives you at least a kind of sense.
It was fantastic. It sounded like trumpets as well coming in.
I mean, it's interesting you say that, because when these were designed, the original idea behind a lot of synthesizers was to emulate live instruments. And so the use of waveforms and the use of filters thought about things being brassy or string-like. We love the sound of things that sound either string-like, voice-like, brass-like. And what's lovely is kind of people forever have taken things that were meant to sound like brass and said, what happens if I plug it in the wrong way? What happens if I use the extremes of this? And so now those extremes have become probably as vital and as important as the original intention.
Freshly mined bleeps there from Dominic Murcott, and Louise McMahon was the reporter. Back this year with a mixed reality event is the Valencia Chamber Music Festival. The festival was the invention of Fidelio trios Dara Morgan and Mary DeLay, created to put chamber music on locations around the island off the coast of Kerry. But this year's story is the one you know by heart. With current restrictions, the team tooled up and, alongside some live events, are making online films of many of their concerts. These include Exploding Stars, a concert which features Morgan on violin playing music from Linda Buckley to Steve Reich, and In the Shadow of St. Mark's, a concert of lesser-known Venetian Baroque music. Dara Morgan spoke to Culturefile about chamber music without chambers.
This all started, I think, back in 2009 when I undertook a tour called the Islands Tour, where I had this idea I wanted to perform on lots of different islands up the west coast of Ireland. The first island I visited was Valencia, and later I visited and performed on the Aran Islands, Inishbofin, and eventually Tory Island, all playing contemporary and older solo violin works. And I was just really taken by Valencia. Oh, it's just a remarkable place. Anybody who's been there is just knows how magical and special it is. You know, from looking out to, you know, the Skelligs on one side, it's just something otherworldly. The term chamber music, or camera music as it was first known, comes from the original idea of room music, from the times when people played in Germany and Austro-Hungarian empires in big chamber rooms for a small group of intimate audience or friends. You know, people like Schubert, for instance, you know, he played mainly in private settings his whole professional life. And for me, it's the most intimate and eloquently sincere and very, very personal, up close with other friends. Musicians have had to really readapt. I wouldn't say adapt, readapt to this last year and a half. We're always readapting as an art form. We've all quickly learnt and hopefully have got at least faster, if not that much better, at making films. You know, you're suddenly in this curatorial space where you're a producer, you're involved in sound design, and you're involved with artistic direction and curatorially who you're going to work with and what music you're going to play. But of course, that should be always what we are as artists. You know, that's what Handel was as an impresario when he was working and living in Dublin, and many other musicians since. Philip Glass, for one, I think, you know, employing his old ensemble and, you know, touring the world with it. It's not a festival if it's only online and recorded elsewhere. Well, that's not really a festival. So it was really important for us to make this huge effort to visit the island, film there, and be in spaces on location to present our concerts from there. Even to do that in this context and at the minute is so difficult to put together. So I feel there's a sense of achievement in making these films on the island. We're not going and doing these in a concert hall in London. We felt it was really important to come to Valencia and record as much of this on the island that we can. You know, the music industry had to hot-footed very quickly in this period we're in, because of course we weren't set up like the sports world, maybe even with licensing and the amount of the projects that were being recorded online or streamed. Music world quickly evolved from the bedroom scenario into something much more polished, and I've really personally enjoyed loads of the different recordings that people have been putting out. I make a joke that with our manager that we have enough high quality publicity broadcast material for about 10 years now, so we hopefully won't be doing this for forever.
Dara Morgan there, and you can find out all the information about on- and offline events at this year's Valencia Chamber Music Festival at chambermusiconvalencia.com. How could a podcast be more like a live event? One audio answer might sound a bit like Neutrino Watch, described by its creators as a generative experimental fiction podcast. Podcast veterans Martin Zaltz-Ostwick and Jeff Empman, for it is they, have created a mini network of imaginary podcasts, from stargazing magazine shows to music, audio diaries, and computerized news bulletins, all assembled and occasionally presented by computers. Culturefile spoke to Martin Zaltz-Ostwick about the other way to create a fascinating, ever-changing daily podcast.
Wendy?
Yes, Ivan?
I'd like to hear the news.
I would like to hear the news.
Is there any news today about Criticize?
Yes. Washington Post World News section reports Iran's supreme leader criticizes US as nuclear talks stalled.
It's easy to create stuff that's completely random.
Ivan?
Yes.
Is there any news about art?
Yes.
AI is interesting in that it's in that space where it's like it's not completely predictable and it's not completely random, and that's sort of where human beings operate, isn't it, in a way?
Wendy, is there any news about Criticize?
Yes. BuzzFeed Politics reports Biden has increased the number of refugees allowed into the US after being criticized for sticking with the Trump-era cap.
Every episode changes every day, so there's a small number of episodes. At the moment, there's about 7 episodes, but each one of those episodes changes every day. So on the day that you download that audio file for the first time, it will be different from what it was yesterday, and then it will be different the next day.
Hello and welcome to Sky Jazz. It's Thursday, the 29th of July, 2021, and we're coming to you tonight from Incheon. It's my favorite place here in Korea, South.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you, Wendy. As ever, we are going to start the show.
It's sort of a collaboration between me and Jeff Entman, who makes Hebe Monsters, and he's been sort of making, I think, more experimental podcasts and stories for a while. And I think we just sort of came together over a few different things we've seen starting to happen.
And you can find out all the information
how can you make
about
podcasts
on-
a little
and offline events
fresher.
At this Every year's Valencia Chamber Music Festival
about
at chambermusiconvalencia.com.
Or choose not to do, by action or omission, create a new universe.
Podcasts are like albums, right? You know, you get your album and you can listen to it again and again. You might spot different things. But the difference between an album and a live performance is if you go to a gig, you know, you might hear a song you hadn't heard before or played a different way, or, you know, the guitar player might trip over their lead and, you know, have to change the solo because their guitar gets unplugged. And so we wanted to sort of reproduce something like that in podcasting, figure out if it was possible to do that. The idea that people had to have a shared experience that was ever so slightly different, that, you know, people could say, well, I went to this Dylan gig and he did this song like this. And, well, I went to this Dylan gig and he changed a verse around and he did it in 3/4 time. And so there's a sort of shared experience, but there's also a personal experience to it. Podcast platforms aren't really built for it. So you have to sort of play around a little bit. If you want to hear it more than once, you have to, you know, delete the episode and re-download it, or you have to stream it every day, because I don't think there's many people really doing this. There are analogies in podcast advertising where people inject adverts. This uses a slightly different technology from that, but that's something that we saw had been used. Welcome to Night Vale actually used that to inject different endings into one of their stories. I think it was about 2 years ago. And I saw that and thought, well, that's a really interesting idea. What if we could use something like that? The important thing about podcasting is that your typical podcast host has an RSS feed, which is like a list of episodes, and that RSS feed will point to a bunch of files. We wrote computer code that could reconstruct each of those files. I mean, the hardest thing really is designing the episodes, but in the simplest example, you probably notice if you go through the feed, they get a little more complex as we go on. There's a story about a guy who's trying to detect neutrinos. And the only change in that changes from day to day is the date. I really like the idea of having something that happens today and you listen to it and you're like, oh, this is happening right now. And kind of like, you know, the killer was inside the house kind of thing. And then the other ones are more complicated. So we have songs where the lyrics change or the instruments change from day to day. Or there's a piece of music which is completely reconstructed from scratch every day. And the idea was always to have a pretty loose fiction so that we could try lots of different ideas out. It's a bit of a playground for us to experiment with things, where the only rule is really it's something that changes every day.
There's only the world outside my window. Human beings cocooning in glass.
So I got a nice email because one of the episodes is called The World Outside My Window. It's a song. And they sent me a nice email saying, I hope you're archiving these because the version on Tuesday was really good. I don't actually keep track, I should. And for that song, even though the things that were changing are relatively straightforward, it has over 500,000 possible combinations. If you configure all of the different lyrics and all of the different guitar solos and all of the different bass parts and drum parts and things like that. I had this idea called the Daily Blast, based on the idea that there's always, especially if you look at a lot of very right-wing American press, there's always something which says, such and such blasts, such and such for da-da-da-da-da, you know. And so he was like, well, what happened if we just look for some of those search terms and we see who's blasting who?
Ivan, is there any news about computer?
Yes. ABC Business has an article called Ford Overcomes Computer Chip Shortage.
I think with all of these things, whether it's AI or whether it's sort of more scripted kind of combinations like we have, it is about setting a set of parameters and then letting something go. And you just have to create an interesting set of rules for a game so that it won't get boring after 5 days. You know, you won't hear the same things or the novelty won't wear off. And that's always an experiment. Some of these episodes, I think, I heard something slightly different, but I don't really want to listen to it again. Whereas other ones, I think you really can come back to again and again and again and have an enjoyable experience each time.
Thank you for giving me the news.
Thank you for giving me the news.
Martin Zolz Ostwick there, and you can find Neutrino Watch wherever you get your podcasts. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with our latest Culture File debate next week when we look at the role of the travel writer in a world where the right to travel might be curtailed by law or by conscience. That's the Culture File debate next Saturday, August 7th, here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.